from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. African-American author Deborah J. Dickerson is angry. Angry at parts of the black leadership in America. Angry at what she sees as the African-American party line. A line that draws back to the past, to slavery, to white domination, to an old definition of what it means to be black. In order to make progress, she says, blacks have to divorce the past. It is, she says, the only way forward. It's also a tall order. Tonight on Point, Deborah J. Dickerson and the end of blackness. But first, we begin in Moscow with the dramatic shakeup of the Russian government. President Vladimir Putin dismissed the prime minister and his entire cabinet earlier today, just weeks before Russia's presidential election. Joining us now from New York to talk about the political reshuffling in Moscow is Christian Carroll, Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Good evening and welcome, Christian Carroll.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Wow, what a shakeup. Why? What does this mean?
Well, you know, there have long been rumors in Moscow that President Putin might be planning to do something like this because the fact of the matter is that when he came into power about 4 years ago, he staffed his government largely with people from the Yeltsin era.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, he's much more of an independent figure. He has an independent power base. And in many ways, we're beginning to see gradually the real Vladimir Putin emerge from his old Yeltsinite husk, if you will.
So he's sacked his prime minister and his entire cabinet. Who's likely to emerge? What's the flavor of power, of person who's likely to emerge in their place? What's the difference likely to be?
Well, I think you're asking the question exactly the right way. We don't really know precisely who will replace the old team. But what we do know is that the people who are coming to the fore now are very much of the old. They're known in Russian as the Siloviki, the people from the old KGB, from the military, from the prosecutor's office, from the police. And these people who are representatives to in many people's minds of sort of the old order have felt very marginalized over the past 10 years in Russia, and they've really felt kind of shut out of the game of power, money, and influence. And under Vladimir Putin, they're definitely coming back in.
Christian Carroll, there's been a lot of talk about Putin moving toward a more traditional Soviet style of strongman rule, fear for the future of democracy there. How does today's sacking of the cabinet factor into that debate?
Well, you see, the old cabinet really had some room for a lot of divergent views. There were people from the old Yeltsin era group. They were known as the family because some of the people in that group were very closely allied with Yeltsin's own daughter and some of his other in-laws. Then there were people who were known as the St. Petersburg liberals, economic reformers from Putin's hometown of St. Petersburg. And then these old-style KGB people that we've been hearing so much about lately. And what we're going to see next is precisely the real face of Vladimir Putin, because the larger context of all this, Tom, is that Vladimir Putin can finally do whatever he wants. Until now, he's had to balance these various forces. He's had to make compromises. He's moved very, very cautiously. But the fact of the matter is that today in Russia, Vladimir Putin has no rivals. He has an extremely docile parliament. The media have been completely subordinated to the state. And really, there are no checks on Vladimir Putin's power now, especially after he wins, as we all expect, a landslide victory in this coming election. So what we're going to see after this election is the real Vladimir Putin without the Yeltsin trappings, without some of this other stuff we've had in the past
few years. It's an open range for Putin. It's your beat. What do you expect that real face of Putin to look like?
Well, I think we're going to see more of the same, only more so. Deja vu all over again, basically.
Meaning
what we're going to see is a very, very authoritarian course. Not much room for the niceties of democracy like, independent voices in the media or a variety of voices in Chechnya. We're going to see a very, very tight, almost police state kind of rule coupled with some sort of free market reforms.
Is Washington going to be able to continue to describe Russia as a democratic ally?
Well, that's a good question. We've been seeing growing tensions between Washington and Moscow in recent weeks, and I think if anything, I'm seeing kind of mutual vague irritation on both sides. The old days of the post 9/11 wonderful alliance and brotherhood between Moscow and Washington are definitely gone.
Christian Carroll, what response have you seen today from the elements of democratic opposition that remain in Russia?
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, Tom, very few, because they are cowed. There are no real, genuinely serious opposition figures. I would say, in my own view, that a lot of the members of the democratic opposition have somewhat compromised themselves, because a lot of them made compromises of various kinds with Putin to stay in power. The fact that Putin combines sort of political authoritarianism with free market economics means that a lot of liberals, so-called liberals in Russia, have tended to say, okay, well, we'll follow him on the free market economics and we'll close an eye to some of these unpleasant political things that have been happening.
There's money to be made here. There's money to be made. Let me ask you finally, Christian, in the United States, for a president to sack his cabinet on the eve of an election would be seen as shocking, even a sign of instability in the president. Do you have a sense of how Russians look at this? Does it look nuts or does it look like an admirable display of authority?
I think in most Russian eyes, it looks more like the latter. It looks more like an admirable display of authority. Of course, Yeltsin sacked his cabinets all the time, right? He changed his ministers every 10 minutes. Putin has most decidedly not done that. Mm-hmm. We've really had to wait 4 years for this kind of decisive action. And in a way, Putin is signaling to his electorate, okay, folks, this is the big time now. Vote for me, and we're going to have real change.
And you'll have me as I am. Christian Carroll, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Christian Carroll is Moscow Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from New York. Author Deborah J. Dickerson is African-American, but not caught up in blackness, she'll tell you, because blackness, as it has come to be understood, Dickerson writes, no longer adequately encompasses what it means to be African-American. It's an antiquated, anti-liberated concept of color and caste, she says, that ties blacks to the past and to victimhood. And Deborah Dickerson is ready to move on. She wants to redefine blackness. It no longer matters if whites hate blacks, she says, on an individual level, she writes. African Americans have to stop living our lives with whites in the equation. In her passionate, provocative new book, The End of Blackness, she insists that blacks need to feel their freedom, take up the victory of the civil rights movement, and move forward. Tonight on Point, author Deborah J. Dickerson and The End of Blackness. Does Deborah Dickerson have it right? Should African Americans move on by divorcing the past, by leaving behind or redefining blackness itself? Is this just the ticket or too easy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Albany, New York, is Deborah J. Dickerson, former senior editor at U.S. News and World Report and author of the memoir An American Story. Her new book is entitled The End of Blackness, Returning the Souls of Black Folk to Their Rightful Owners. Good evening and welcome, Deborah Dickerson.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. What an interesting and provocative book. And one that we want to be sure we really understand.
Well, I'm all ticked off now after hearing that intro. It's like, wow, who wrote that book? You
know? Well, we're pulling that intro largely from your own words, Deborah Dickerson, but we really want to understand exactly where you're headed with The End of Blackness, and we might as well start right with the title because you named it in a way that's going to get right in people's face. What do you mean by The End of Blackness?
Right. Well, I meant to get in people's faces. What I mean by The End of Blackness is not this notion that we need to stop being black, we need to be human beings. I don't mean that at all.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is that we need to be more black. And the way to be more black is to cohere a black identity around much more than opposition to white people, which is what it sort of come to be understood as. And the reason I ended up writing this book, because I'm 44 years old, but I've spent, you know, pretty much the first 35 years of my life trying to figure out how to be black in the modern era in a way that took cognizance of the fact that we had a civil rights movement that didn't end racism and didn't make everything perfect, but that did sort of unlock the doors of opportunity. And what were the ways to push those doors open? And the way I was being led was sort of to stand at the door and talk about how firmly shut it was, as opposed to putting my shoulder to it and, you know, right or wrong, whether America was great or awful or whatever, being able to walk through that door as opposed to having a whole bunch of things to complain about.
So define, I guess, guess if you would, how you understand the meaning of blackness as commonly used, as commonly understood. You say that this concept is rapidly losing its ability to describe, let alone predict or manipulate, the political and social behavior of African Americans, but yet it's out there. What is the common understanding, or the black understanding, if that's the most important thing here, of blackness?
Well, I think we can look at some sort of silly things, and it makes it sort of easy for people to make fun of me, but that's okay. I've gotten 300 or 400 emails in the last week or so that tell me that I'm getting through to sort of everyday people, black and white.
Well, we didn't come to make fun of you. We really want to know.
Well, but no, and that's okay. I'm really trying to answer the question, but I think that in some ways it helps to sort of look at silly examples, and it was
okay.
The sort of silly examples that made me understand that I had some serious things to think about. When I was on staff at U.S. News and World Report, Black History Month, I would get these sort of emails, Deborah, show up at this time at this place to sort of man the Black History booth. You know, Deborah, show up at this time at this place to man the National Association of Black Journalists booth and here and there. And there were all
show your flag, show your face, in other words.
Well, but there was the assumption that I belonged to these organizations and that I automatically wanted to be involved with them and that this was the way and that no matter where I was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I was black, more than I was anything else. And I have so much in common with journalists, whether they're black, white, mm-hmm. Asian, Native American, but nobody ever said, Deborah, show up at this place at this time for, you know, the Association of Journalists meeting. So there was this assumption, you know, and a friend of mine whose kids are in a private school, the end of the year, they asked, you know, the Rosencrantz's to do a Hanukkah display. They
right.
asked this person, the O'Reilly's, to do a Christmas display. And they asked a black friend of mine, whose kids were among the only black kids in the school, to talk about Kwanzaa. Mm. He wouldn't know Kwanzaa from Adam, you know. So these very sort of knee-jerk, sort of one-inch-deep renderings of black culture as sort of the direct opposite of white culture in a way that I just find that my husband is white. My kids are blonde, you know, and it just Tiger Woods, he's black, but not black. So I find that sort of we're put into boxes as black people and white people. And of course, I'm leaving out Hispanics and Asians and all sorts of other things.
Right. So that's an easy one. That's putting race above everything else. But as I read your book, The End of Blackness, what I found more interesting really than this kind of thing, which sounds like imposed from, maybe imposed by whites, imposed by non-blacks, more of your discussion goes to African Americans' own sense of blackness and how they
right.
define it among and to themselves. Speak to that.
Right. Well, quickly, those examples I gave were all black people.
Oh, all right. Okay.
But to get to your larger point, definitely within the black community, there is a sort of what I find to be crushing groupthink, a crushing what I call in the book this black Politburo that sort of sets itself up in judgment on the black community and decides what is or is not black. And if you don't typify these things, you're for affirmative action, you're opposed to interracial marriage, you're anti-black Republicans, because black conservatives are evil, they're self-hating, all these sorts of things. There was this sort of litmus test of things you had to believe, and rather than a focus on eliminating racism or dealing with the concrete problems in the black community, so much more effort went into keeping you from veering from the party line, witness the amount of vitriol that gets, you know, slung at Clarence Thomas, which would seem to be sort of the least of our problems in the black community. So there's definitely a policing and a groupthink and a very sort of intellectual fascism that goes on sort of in the chattering class of black people that is the main impetus for my having written this book.
And you describe it as tied to the past and to always comparing oneself or one's race to whites.
Yes. Well, it's not so much comparing. That's one thing, comparing ourselves to whites and saying, okay, who has the highest percentage of people exemplifying this negative thing? Who has the greatest number of out-of-wedlock births? Who has the greatest number of this or that? And I think that's a very sort of one-note, very simplistic. It doesn't really matter how many hours a week white kids spend watching television if you're a black person and you care about the black community.
We've got a lot more to get into. We've got to take a break. We're talking about The End of Blackness, a new book by African-American writer Deborah J. Dickerson. You can join the conversation. Thanks to the civil rights movement, black people are free and thriving, so she says. And it's time to move on from victimhood. Do you agree? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about The End of Blackness, a new book by African-American writer Deborah J. Dickerson. You can join our conversation. Are too many African-Americans, as Deborah Dickerson says, defining themselves out of America because of bitterness over the country's unfinished racial business? Does this sound like get over it, move on? Is that the most promising attitude for African-Americans now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Deborah Dickerson, describe, if you would, your forward-looking prescription then. You don't want to look back. You want to look forward. Look forward with what attitude, with what posture?
With courage, because it's a scary prospect. When you give up defining your identity in direct opposition to white people and around your sort of past oppression and even current oppression in a climate of opportunity, you have to figure, then you have to get back to basic transcendent principles. And to figure out what those were, I had to go back to Frederick Douglass, Dr. King, Carter G. Woodson, Gandhi even, Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin, people like that. And if you parse through that and you ask yourself, why are these books classics? Why are these thinkers, classical thinkers? And they were leading us to transcendent principles of nobility. And Dr. King talked about justice, not so much anti-racism, but what was just and what was unjust. And so you look to those principles and you look to community-centered solutions. If we've got a problem with, you know, police brutality, you can't just declare war on the police department. That's just a no-win situation. You have to figure out ways to partner with the police department, figure out why it is that they can see us in such a dehumanized way, understand that we have a common agenda, we both want crime low, and figure out ways to work on a partnership. So it's a sort of ratchet back the rhetoric, the anti-racism rhetoric, to sort of get where you want to be. If your whole program is getting somebody to admit they're a racist, I think that's unlikely to be successful.
Deborah Dickerson, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Los Angeles Darnell Hunt. He's professor of sociology and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African-American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Good evening and welcome, Darnell Hunt.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for joining us. Deborah's here as well. Darnell Hunt, you hear the argument, and you must know it. Deborah Dickerson raises it with a lot of passion, but it's not the first time in recent years that it's been put out there. What do you make of this train of thought?
Well, I should just give you the caveat. I have not read the book. I've read a little bit about it. I'm really looking forward to looking it over. But from what I can tell and from listening to the beginning of the show, it sounds like an argument that's quite reminiscent of arguments that folks like Shelby Steele, for example, have raised in The Content of Our Character.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that we need to somehow or another move beyond the victim status in the African-American community. My response to that argument is that victim status has never been the sum total of our identity in the African-American community. I think that certainly many African Americans have felt themselves personally victims, and the group as a whole has certainly been victim to certain atrocities in American history. But I think going back to some of those same works that Ms. Dickerson quoted, there's always been an element of duality in the African American community, whereby we understood that at the same time that we were victims of an unjust system, we still had to strive as individuals and as members of a community to move forward against the odds. And I think that African Americans have been incredibly noble in doing so over the years.
Given where African Americans stand today, and that's a very broad generalization, but is it then helpful to your mind to have this kind of further kick in the pants from a writer like Deborah Dickerson saying, come on, look more forward and less back?
Well, you know, I think that it's healthy to have dialogue and debate around issues like this because, you know, obviously we're talking about complex issues.
Sure.
Race has been
sure.
with our society since before it was a nation, and it's still with us, obviously. We haven't done all the work yet, and we need to have a myriad of voices, you know, offering perceptions. We don't want to have a univocal discussion about, you know, tactics or strategies. So it's good. I think it's refreshing to have different points of view. Doesn't mean that we all have to agree on the points of view. I don't happen to subscribe to this particular thesis, but I do think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done. It's not just an issue of black meaning anti-white. I think that in my own family, just by way of example, I think that there is some understanding of oppression that African Americans have historically endured, but I was always told that I have to be better than everyone else. I've always strived to be better. I've always felt that I had to work harder. So it was never an issue of, oh, just because somehow or another the system is stacked against me, then I'm excused from having to work harder.
Right.
That's unfortunately the implication that we take away from these arguments somehow. You sort of put the burden back on the quote-unquote victim, him or herself, as opposed to looking at the system and the structures underlying the system that are still doing a lot of the work. That doesn't mean that individuals don't have to work hard. They have to.
Deborah Dickerson, let me turn back to you for a moment. What do you hear? Darnell Hunt says, live with the duality. Live with the legacy of the past and elements of victimhood and structural discrimination that still go on, and look forward. Do you accept that, or is that slicing it down the middle? Do you want a more forward-leaning posture even than that?
No, I hope, Dr. Hunt, if you're still in line, I hope you'll drop me an email. We can have a conversation. Thank you for, sort of jumping the gun. And you wouldn't believe the emails and the sort of knee-jerk the responses that I get. And I appreciate you saying that you hope to sort of flip through the book. And we are, believe me, you don't disagree with me as much as it might seem. You're absolutely right. That duality has always been there. And there's always been at the same time, I mean, Du Bois talked about this double consciousness. And it works in a couple of different ways. And one is, and in the book, I spend a third of the book talking about what's left of white racism and how it very much affects black people's lives. I am not one of these people who says, what racism? I don't know what you're talking about.
Right, but
you do write, you say blacks need leaders looking to the limitless future, not to the hunched over past.
Exactly. And I think I wrote this book because I was thirsting for this kind of leadership and for thirsting for people to tell me who I am, what I'm capable of, how I'm supposed to go about being black in a post-movement construct, and all they're telling me is how awful white people are. And I went to, it took me forever. I was 34, 35 before I really got my life together, when I was a person who never got in trouble. I called myself Gold Star Debbie, scholarships and all this stuff, but I didn't take them because no one was telling me what I could aspire to as a black person. All they were telling me, and I didn't come from a politicized background. Maybe if I had, I would have been hearing some of these messages. But my parents were great migration sharecroppers who just sort of sent us to school, and they were hoping I would be a secretary, which to them was a wonderful thing. Mm. And when I would join the Black Student Union, this and the other thing, and all they wanted to do was tell me about white people. Well, who am I? What am I capable of? And I had to look to Frederick Douglass for that, you know?
Darnell Hunt, I know we only have you for another minute. Deborah Dickerson writes, let's look for black leaders who are excited and hopeful, not bitter and defeated. And she paints some significant number of contemporary black leaders with that bitter and defeated brush. Is that fair?
Well, you know, again, I haven't seen the individuals that she's sort of identified as bitter, embittered. All I can say is that, leaders, the term leader implies, of course, that people are following. So, if people are, have a certain perspective and there is a following, their message resonates with people, there must be some value in what they're saying in terms of, the experiences that people have had. Black leadership throughout the time that African Americans have been here on this continent, has wrestled with these questions of nationalism, the group kind of separating and dealing with itself and raising itself up because the broader society was hostile, versus black leaders who've talked more about integration, that somehow or another we would overcome, race and racism, and that we could become a part of the broader mainstream society. And then there are those people in the middle. And I think, depending upon the politics, we've oscillated back and forth between those poles in terms of which seemed to be most appropriate. There were periods I can think of in growing up when, I think the outlook was a lot more positive than it is today. I mean, we live in times where, there's a lot of mistrust and a lot of cynicism about our national path as it pertains to race. And I think there are a lot of people who don't feel that we're genuinely moving forward, that somehow or another we've stalled or we've gone back. And I think that may have reignited concern among a lot of people who want to make those comparisons between blacks and whites and see blackness as more anti-white now than possibly in the past when times seemed better. That's been true through our nation's history. So I think we may be at a particular point where some of these concerns are expressed more more overtly than in the past, I should
We're
say.
Not everybody's necessarily ready for the end of blackness, as Deborah Dickerson defines it.
I don't think so. In fact, if anything, I'm seeing, or at least sensing, particularly among some youth, a resurgence of quote-unquote blackness as opposed to African-American, which, you know, there are two terms that are often used interchangeably, but, you know, historically they're rooted in different periods.
And the distinction being?
Well, I think blackness is a much more adversarial type of term. It's a term that...
not the inclusive, hyphenated American.
It's meant to allude to or reference whiteness. I mean, black and white, they're binary opposites. I won't get into semiotics here, but there is a relationship between black and white in this country that's enduring. African-American was an attempt in the mid-'80s, I guess, to step away from that, to kind of look more at, you know, Africa and African, you know, the diaspora and African culture.
A seat at the round table.
And to think of us like other ethnic Americans as an ethnic group as opposed to necessarily a racial group. Mm-hmm. And there's a distinction there between race and ethnicity. But the resulting politics look very differently, I think.
Darna Hunt, I know we have to let you go, and we committed to it, and we'll do it, but we thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I learned a lot from that, and I hope you'll drop me an email, Deborah@DeborahDickerson.com.
Oh, boy, you'll get plenty now.
Yeah, okay. I've gotten a lot, and I've really been humbled, and I've learned a lot from. I've gotten like 400 emails in the last few weeks.
Well, watch out. You'll have more coming. Darnell Hunt, thank you very much for joining us. From Los Angeles, Darnell Hunt, professor of sociology and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. Carrick is calling from Boston. Hi, Carrick. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Great, thank you.
I have a two-part comment.
Yeah.
One is really concerns the title, that I think the title is really inconsistent with the argument as I've heard it presented by your guest. I haven't read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is about the presence of class in your guest's argument. The first part is that the title is provoking these knee-jerk responses, when in fact I don't think it's really accurate. I don't think you're talking about ending blackness. You're just changing, redefining, which is something we go through every generation.
Mm-hmm.
The danger is you're going to associate those yourself with those people who are pure assimilationists and people who want to erase the racial argument.
Ignore color, ignore race entirely. Mm-hmm.
Pardon me?
Ignore color, ignore race entirely.
That's right, and talk only about the question of class and say that racial arguments, because those are the people who do want to set racism itself under erasure and pretend
it's okay, we've got that point. And your second?
The second one is that, you know, it sounds like your author has benefited mightily from the civil rights movement and affirmative action and is ready to leave race behind because she's done so well. And there are a lot of people in prison, in inadequate school systems, inadequate relationship to the education system, to healthcare system, to the job market, who are being brutalized. They're brutalized by states that have Confederate flags hanging. They're brutalized by a president who's really basically running a white people's party. It's not vestiges of racism. It's a resurgent racism. It's really governing the structure of the political debate in this country.
Carrick, you've got some hot points here. Please stick with us. Deborah Dickerson, how do you respond? First, on the title.
You know, if you go into bookstores today, you will see about 100,000 million books. I wasn't trying to write a book that no one would read. And I, being a member of this community, I had a message that I thought was important to get out. And when I think about this topic myself, as a black person who's been black in America for 44 years, it was a topic that spoke to me. And if you read the book, and I would suggest you do that before you form hard and fast opinions, when I talk about the fact that I'm talking about ending blackness, I think blackness is ending. It's not my call to end blackness in a particular way. I think it was a pre-movement sort of way of looking at ourselves that was sort of necessary in a question of survival that has sort of outgrown its utility. To get to the caller's second question again, I would suggest you flip through my book before, frankly, you make a fool of yourself. I am the daughter of two great migration sharecroppers who didn't even go to high school. My father drove a truck and sort of a Sanford and Son kind of thing. He was an itinerant truck driver. My mother was a cook, waitress, cleaning lady, that sort of thing. I went to Harvard Law School, but not until after I dropped out of Florissant Valley Community College. I got my bachelor's and my master's at night while working full-time in the United States Air Force. I think I know a little something about the bottom of the barrel. Just last week, I was part of a contingent that went up to pick a family member up from a couple of years in jail. I'm very much involved with community programs. I spend a lot of time. I talk in prisons. I spend a lot of time on a prisoner reentry program where I live here in Albany. I really don't need anybody to explain to me the plight of the black people, working class black people in America.
Well, but Carrick doesn't sound like
anybody's fool at first blush, and he's raising this issue of, you know, there are a lot of people and a lot of black people in very tough circumstances. Does your message apply equally regardless of class standing?
Yes. If you are a poor black person coming from very straitened background, non-college-going background, your parents didn't really know how the school system worked or any of that stuff, are you better off focusing on the evil of white people? Are you better off focusing on what opportunities there are for you? I mean, I was a designated gifted kid, and I still had to get my bachelor's and master's at night while working full-time.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been better off if somebody had told me who I was and what I was capable of, instead of spending all this effort and a lot more effort went into telling me how awful white people were than to telling me how wonderful I was and where I come from and not to be ashamed. And yes, the odds are stacked against you and things are hard, but you can do it. You're made of stern stuff, as opposed to telling me how evil white people are.
Carrick, there's the elaboration. What do you make of it?
I would love to respond. I think, first of all, thanks for your concern over my ability to make a fool of myself, but I'll worry about that. The second part I wanted to say is that I really like your argument, but I think of it as a tactical one. We're not throwing out blackness, but trying to define it as a positive identity source, number one. Number two is the fact is you worked really hard. I'm not trying to take that away from you. But there were opportunities that civil rights leaders created for you. And the thing you're asking for, the thing you wished you had had, is something the black nationalist movement could have provided you, which is the strong sense of your racial identity as a positive identity. So that doesn't mean throw out blackness. That calls for a tactical readjustment.
Carrick, we're losing your phone there, but it's a great call, and we thank you so much for making it. Deborah Dickerson, what do you say?
Read the book. The first 10 or 15 pages will tell you what this 20-minute conversation cannot, which is my definition of what I mean by the ending of blackness, which is let's not be black, let's be human beings. Let's be more black. Let's be black in a proactive way that's about us and not in opposition to somebody else.
You say a lot of air will be let out of the balloon of racism the moment blacks stop paying attention to it and focus on their own internalities.
Exactly. I mean, which is not to say, you know, there's a Klan movement in your city, ignore it. I'm not saying that. You know, just this weekend, coming home from a book tour thing, I was discriminated against in the Cleveland airport. I'm not saying that racism isn't alive and well, but that doesn't stop me from being a published author who gets her butt in her chair every day to do her work. You know, I haven't seen my kids tonight because I'm here doing this radio show. So racism doesn't stop me from doing what I have to do. Racism motivates me to continue what I have to do. And what I have to do is not trying to get white people to admit how racist they are.
Well, we're glad you're here doing it. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about The End of Blackness, a new book by African-American writer Deborah J. Dickerson. You can join the conversation. Should African-Americans focus on their own talents and ignore the expectations of whites and other blacks, as Deborah Dickerson suggests? White listeners, do you feel comfortable offering any prescriptive advice to black Americans? And black listeners, what do you think of Deborah Dickerson's advice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about The End of Blackness, a new book by African-American writer Deborah J. Dickerson. She joins us tonight from Albany, New York. You can join the conversation as well. What does it mean, as Deborah Dickerson says, for blacks to divorce the past and embrace tomorrow as their only option? And is this a conversation that all races have a place in, or is it really for the black community itself to hash out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from Atlanta, Georgia, by Elaine Brown. In 1974, Elaine Brown became the first and only woman to lead the Black Panther Party. Her books include A Taste of Power and New Age Racism and the Condemnation of Little B. She's vice president of the Huey P. Newton Foundation and president of the nonprofit educational corporation Field of Flowers. Good evening and welcome, Elaine Brown.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Elaine, you've heard a little bit of this conversation. You may have read a bit about Deborah Dickerson's book. You must know this thrust, this sort of let's look forward, let's not be bogged down in victimhood line of thinking. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that it erases all reality and objectivity and the facts of life and centers on some notion that America is a great place if you just really squeeze your eyes together and work hard, everything will just work out. It's the most absurd argument I've ever actually heard, but it speaks to what I call a New Age racism, which is a kind of participation in the continuation of racism for other blacks, that the problem in America is not America, but it's something in ourselves.
That is, don't look at the structural issues, don't look at racism. Deborah Dickerson says forthrightly, look inside.
That's correct, and that is the most, for me, the most absurd argument I've ever heard. It smacks of Plessy. It's sort of a dark, she's kind of a dark-skinned Homer Plessy arguing that she's not really black anyway, or Ellis Coase, who talks about black progress sort of in the voice of Porgy singing, I've got plenty of nothing, nothing's plenty for me. Condoleezza Rice, who went to Stanford University on affirmative action and yet shuns affirmative action. Clarence Thomas, who denounces affirmative action, although he went to Holy Cross on affirmative action. It's the school of Dinesh D'Souza, Shelby Steele, and Wardell Connolly. The bottom line is, let's just say that we as people can really individualize ourselves and not exist in the constructs of America itself, and this is this refutes and this goes against reality itself.
Deborah Dickerson, here's a passionate refutation. How do you step up to it?
It was passionate, but it wasn't very thoughtful. It doesn't refer to anything except a bunch of sort of knee-jerk wannabe Marxist tropes. You know what? I'll give you and you know, it's sad because we sort of I followed her on C-SPAN this week, and of course have followed her career, and very much enjoyed the condemnation of Little B. One of the things I'm most proud of is having tracked down and written the life story of the guy who shot my nephew in the back and crippled him at 16 for having waved at him. I tracked the guy down and wrote his life story because I knew there was an interesting story to tell about a black man who could do that to a 16-year-old black man.
But Elaine Brown says this is New Age racism. You're walking away from structural issues that confront black people in America.
Well, it's easy to say when you already know everything and you don't have to actually listen to what anybody else has to say if they're not saying exactly what you hear every day in your sort of little wannabe Marxist re-education camp meetings. I think, again, I would suggest, you know, it would just sort of be a waste of time, but you might want to flip the book before you compare me to Dinesh D'Souza, someone who I have taken on in the discourse and debated. Throwing out these names and these little Marxist flashcards, I mean, really, this isn't an actual debate. This is just
well,
spooky.
It isn't a question of a debate. It's a question of what is the objective reality for the masses of people, not for this one individual. It would be like saying that everybody can really be president if you really, really try harder. We can all be Oprah if we really, really try harder.
Or we can all
I'm talking about 94% of children who are tried as adults in the state of Georgia, for example, are black children. 80% of children in Atlanta public schools, 90% qualify for free or subsidized. But half of the prisoners in America are black people, over 2 million people. Black infant mortality rate, double that of white. 65% of AIDS people victims of AIDS are children, black children and black women, double the rate of cancer death. These things don't have anything to do with yes, I can, and I wish I were, or any Air Force slogans about can I be, live, be all I want
to
be. This has nothing to do with Marxism. It has to do with It has to do with some individualistic notion.
How was I able to circumvent that?
That was wonderful. You're a wonderful person, and I know that had a lot to do with what a great person you are, but now that you've talked about yourself, you and Oprah can go off into the sunshine together. Bottom line is you're not dealing with the masses and the objective reality, whether you want to call it Marxism or anything
you
want to call me.
Where are you leading the masses, Elaine?
Elaine Brown, let me ask you, do you see the effort of an individual black person to look forward on their own merits, or their own strengths, whatever it may be, and work off of those as illusory, as delusional? It just won't work without a major structural change.
I see it as selfish and self-serving, and I don't see it as concerned with the human condition of other people and how you yourself got to where you are. There's a notion that Oprah Winfrey says the same thing. You know, I prayed and I worked hard, and that's how I became Oprah Winfrey. Condoleezza Rice says the same. These are the people that say this kind of thing, but the majority of our people are not living under these conditions. So this is delusory, and it makes people imagine that one can really work hard in America.
We got it. I can't really hear you at the same time, but Deborah Dickerson, let me ask you, what about it? Does your advice apply to every young African-American out there?
Could you just tell me what her advice is?
Well, as I hear it, she's saying it's
advice.
As I hear it, and Elaine Brown, this is presumptuous of me, but it's you can't. There are a lot of people who won't be able to make it on their own because there are structural challenges that they face.
What's the advice?
Well, I assume that means structural change.
Hunker down, first of all, and have a little bit of love and human compassion in your heart for your own people and decide that you want to do something more than talk about your little petty life and your own thing.
About people like you.
Well, that's very generous, and actually it's very white of you.
Okay.
Oh, gee, really. And I guess, do you repudiate Dr. King?
Not at all. I embrace Dr. King.
Well, then how can you do, and what you just said.
At the end of his life, when he talks about the redistribution of wealth, which you might probably don't know anything about the end of his life.
Elaine Brown, you've made your perspective vividly clear, and we thank you for joining us tonight. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Elaine Brown, in 1974, she became the first and only woman to head the Black Panther Party. She joined us tonight from Atlanta, Georgia. Oh, Deborah Dickerson, that is a perspective that's really not comfortable with yours.
What perspective is it? It's a perspective of spewing hate and vomit. Could you just please tell me what her program is?
Her program?
Yes. How are Black people, who she says are living under this incredible oppression, okay, I'll buy that. I know all those statistics she spouted off. What is her plan for Black people escaping this horrible situation that they're in besides hating white people and just sort of cataloging and massaging it and going over and over it? What is her plan?
I won't be presumptuous enough to speak to that, but let me ask you, is this then the kind of personification, is this the kind of leadership that you're saying, no, that way won't work?
Yes.
And take us to the heart of your critique of it.
If your program is to catalog how awful white people are, then listen to Elaine Brown. If your program is to escape this horrible situation that she and I both agree that you're in, listen to me. I'm not saying America is wonderful. I am not saying that I did not benefit from all these leaders. How could I quote them and not understand that I benefited from it?
And you quote them at length.
At length, because I had to go back to the past, because people like Elaine Brown in the present were not leading me anywhere. All they were doing was telling me how awful white people are. And that's why it took me till my 30s before I got myself together, because I could give you chapter and verse about how awful white people are.
But the crux of...
I couldn't tell you who I was.
I hear you. The crux of what I heard there was essentially there has to be some great structural change, or else this is advice that just won't work for people. There'll be too many individuals who are banging their head against a wall and won't get ahead and will feel, you know, that they have failed, that they're lousy for some reason. Are you saying that one by one African Americans can surmount these issues, or that they're not there?
Those of us who have made it out have a responsibility to spend a certain amount of time going on about white racism, because it's real and the structural inequalities and all that stuff are real. A lot of people need to be sued. A lot of people need to be marched against. But I don't know. Am I crazy, or was this woman spewing hatred of the kind that Dr. King would definitely have not agreed with? Some of us have to focus on that. The majority of us need to focus in the Black community. It's so much easier to go on the radio and talk about what white people need to do. It's a lot harder to go into the Black community and work on prisoner reentry, work with welfare mothers, establish charter schools. We have to roll our sleeves up and do the stuff that's unglamorous, that won't get us television and that won't get us, you know, tenured positions at white universities from which we can spew hatred about white people. What we need to do is go back into the communities, not with car washes and bake sales, but with the billions of dollars that we contribute to this country with our earnings and that sort of thing, and work on what can be accomplished in the Black community without having to, you know, scrape the last residue of racism from the last white heart. She may be focused on white people, but I'm not.
Deborah Dickerson, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. We won't get to them all, but let's see what we can do here. Alex is calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
I would just have an issue just to ask Ms. Dickerson about and see what her two cents are about it. There's a lot of, you know, a lot. We have a lot of kids who are born now who are biracial. One parent is white, one is Black. And I just noticed, you know, I'm a college professor, and I myself am, I'm not married to a Black woman, but I'm married to a woman from Colombia, and I'm white. And the thing about it, what I see is that in the African-American community, there's a lot of problem accepting identity, even if a kid is born to a one white parent and one parent who's half white, half
Of accepting
Black.
Exactly what, Alec? Of accepting what?
Well, I mean, accepting that the child might have an identity that's not 100% wholly black, that it might be something else, that it might be, you know, a combination of different things. And
two cultures at least.
Yeah, yeah.
Deborah Dickerson, can you speak to that?
If you listen to Elaine Brown, he has to be black 24 hours a day. I was of that school until a couple years ago that if the person isn't black, they're self-hating and they just don't want to be black because they're racist. And then I heard Tiger Woods say a couple years ago that he doesn't consider himself to be black because it's an insult to his mother, who is Thai.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sort of blew a hole in my head. That's absolutely right. That is an insult to his mother. How can one parent's identity completely – see, we have gotten so far away from our intellectual and moral heritage in this community. Dr. King – what would Dr. King say about that if he was here now? You cannot erase one parent. That's, it's racist. It's racist to say only the black parent counts. And the kids have to find a way to incorporate both aspects of their personality. Please tell me what the alternative to that is.
We've got it, and it's a great answer. I want to get one more call in. And Alex, thanks for your call. Bill is calling from Ladysmith, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad you had time to get me on.
Good to have you.
I just wanted to say that I totally agree with your guest tonight. She's hit the nail right on the head. You know, the thing is, discrimination isn't limited to just black people. You know, if yellow people, red people, white people. I've been discriminated against. I'm as white as you get. You know, I was in the Army for 10 years, and the unit I was first stationed in was 80% black, and I was discriminated against, flat out. There's no question about it. But, you know, like she said, if you want to get ahead in the world, you got to put your foot forward, your heart forward. And that's how you get ahead in the world. You don't get it any other way. There ain't no handouts anymore.
Bill, you know, we got it. Our time is so short, but I want to thank you for your call. Deborah Dickerson, an interesting point and call. How do you ask white readers, white listeners, to hear your argument? Has Bill got it?
You know, Bill, I don't want to minimize your suffering, but, you know, if you had not gone to that place at that time, you would not have experienced that. I'm not trying to minimize your pain, but it's not the same as being the member of a despised group that's been oppressed since 1619, when the first 20 black indentured servants were brought here against their will. I'm not minimizing what might have happened to you in a majority black group, but it should give you some insight into maybe not your own oppression, but into ours, because as soon as you left that unit, that ended. But
is he on to your core message, which is kind of pick it up and go forward, my friend?
I don't know what the alternative to that is. Whatever situation you're in, you have to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and say, okay, I'm not responsible for the oppression in the world. I'm responsible for my response to it. And is my plan to sort of catalog how oppressed I am, or is my plan to sort of rise above it? So I don't know what the I would like to think that if I found myself in a concentration camp or in a prison or on an AIDS ward, I would sort of try to dust myself off and do the best I could rather than just sort of lay there and curse the virus that made me sick.
Deborah Dickerson, we've just scratched the surface, but you've been a good sport tonight, and we appreciate your sharing with us. Thanks so much for coming on. It's great to have you. Deborah Dickerson joined us from Albany, New York. She's author of The End of Blackness, Returning the Souls of Black Folk to Their Rightful Owners. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.